want to hear louder? All right, could you turn the mic up more? I don't want to have to yell like this. Oh, is that better? Okay. I'm going to do mine sitting down. He's going to stand there, which means he's going to stand. But I'm going to tell you something about the music that's going to start off this final concert of the season. You have program notes, and I'll be probably repeating some of them. But the initial fanfare for brass was written for the Dallas Symphony Orchestra to consider as a wake-up call for people to come back to see the second half and hear the second half of the concert. Instead of doing bells or making an announcement, they thought, how about having a fanfare to announce to people that the second half is about time to start? So I wrote out a fanfare, and along with a lot of other people that wrote fanfares, because they're only 3 or 4 minutes long, so you can write it and send it out. I have no idea who won. I have no idea if they're using it or whatever. But we'll use it here tonight. And it's scored for a usual brass choir. This means 4 trumpets, 4 horns, 3 trombones and a tuba, timpani, and cymbals and bass drum. It's a very simple form. It's in 3 parts, ABA. This means that the third part is going to sound like the first part, only the third part has an ending that the first part didn't have. Middle half is more like a song, it's singable, and you'll be able to follow it very easily. The second piece, a little history here. I did write at the 25th anniversary, and whether it was the 25th anniversary of the orchestra or my 25th anniversary, I can't remember, because everything's off by 1 year. I've conducted the orchestra every year except the first year. So I did write one suite to the 25th anniversary suite. Well, now we're up to 50. So I decided to write, while I was in England a couple of years ago, a California Golden Suite. Well, it'll be my golden year, 50 years. So it was fortunate. I was on the University of York campus, and they gave me a office. That is a room with a window, very important. Table and a chair. No telephone, nothing to disturb me. So I decided to write. And I wrote, it's in 3 movements. The first one I thought I had been, for some reason, earlier than that, I'd been listening to Dave Brubeck's Take 5. Oh, that's a great tune. It's in 5/4 time. We can play 5/4 time. If Dave Brubeck can do it, I'm sure we can do it by now. So I wrote something in 5/4 time. That swings a little bit. The orchestra had a good time with it. What else can I say about 5/4 time? Terribly repetitive.
Well, the drums had a lot of fun with it.
Oh, the drums, right? Drums, yeah. When I get out of ideas, I say, well, let's have the drums play for about 4 bars and give them something to do. The second movement, I wrote especially to feature the English horn. So I dropped the brasses, except for horns, and dropped the percussion. And this is a ballad. And it goes rather quite slow, but does feature that unusual instrument that we heard last week from hearing the New World Symphony. I wrote this for our principal oboist. The last movement, I guess I got a little homesick. Because, one more thing. In the first movement, how can I make this sound English? And at that time I heard, bum, 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 bum. Well, I'll incorporate that into the first movement. It's a lot like that. You may hear it. Third movement, I thought, maybe I'm well, let's see. What do we think of? Dum da dum 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 da dum 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 dum. That's Star Spangled Banner, isn't it? Yeah. And America the Beautiful. Those are two tunes we all know. So I'll try to combine those, kind of being a little homesick. And so I put those together, and it's in a march. It's in a march form, and you'll love it. You will love it. It's fun to play, and it's a toe-tapper. And that's the extent to what I did on the first half of the program. The second half of the program is nothing but the Tchaikovsky, which is a good 50 to 55 minutes long. So the second half will be longer than the first half, but we'll still not get out of here before 10 o'clock. Peter will tell us some facts and something about
stuff.
About
they gave me my own. How about that? Well, I like to stand as I talk, and it's mostly because I like to pace while I stand while I talk. But I want to tell you about, as Art says, about the Tchaikovsky Symphony No. 5, Pyotr Ilyich Tchaikovsky. You know, I love speaking Russian. I don't speak Russian, but I like pronouncing it, because when you speak Russian, you feel like you are saying something. Da, da. And so, da. So Tchaikovsky was a giant in the Russian school. He was one of the first of the composers of the Russian school, which came to prominence in the early to mid 19th century. He was quite precocious. He started piano when he was 5 years old, and he quickly got to the place where he could play anything that his teacher put before him by the age of 8. And so his teachers basically said, you know, you're on your own, here's the music, do what you want with it. And he would have loved to have a career in music, except that musicians, then as now, don't make any money, and they generally don't get hired any place. And the only place that you could do this in Russia at the time was either to be a teacher in the academy, and there were probably 4 or 5 posts there that you could actually apply for with a competition in the thousands, or you could be an instrumentalist in one of the imperial theaters. And of course, the competition for that was quite tight. So Tchaikovsky's parents basically launched him on a career of civil service, and they put him in, what was the name of it? The Imperial School of Jurisprudence. And he was trained to be a functionary in the Tsar's government. And that was the sort of thing that, in this time, you actually had to start schooling for civil service when you were 12 years old. And what that meant for Tchaikovsky is that he was actually shipped out of his hometown, which was in the southern Ukraine, all the way to Moscow to go to school at the age of 12. So that distance is 1,500 miles, so he basically had no family. And you can imagine that that's going to be fairly traumatic for any 12-year-old child to be shipped away and have school basically see your parents once a year. But that's basically what happened to Tchaikovsky. He did finish his schooling at the jurisprudence school, and he did become a civil servant. And that was a post that he held for a total of 3 years. And what ultimately happened was he realized that this was completely a waste of his time. He knew he loved music. He knew that he wanted to do music. And so he made enough money from his civil service job that he could actually enroll in the then brand new St. Petersburg Conservatory of Music. And the people who were teaching there were people like Modest Mussorgsky and Alexander Borodin and Rimsky-Korsakov, a couple of other figures of that nature. So he started his schooling there and showed his compositional talent quite early. Now, what's interesting when you look at biographies of Tchaikovsky is that I found this when I was looking into this. I found that he is actually one of the most studied composers. And the reason for that is most people have spent a lot of time on his personal life, because we know that he lived a life of constant chaos and personal trauma. And a lot of biographers have made a lot of his homosexuality. and how that was must have been difficult for him to deal with, and how did this express itself in his art, and all of that kind of stuff. And what you find when you read these biographies is that depending on the time that the biography is written, it says more about the nature of the history at the time that the biography was written than it really says about Tchaikovsky. One thing that makes it difficult is that after Tchaikovsky became quite famous as a composer, the Soviet state, which came about in 1917, you may remember the October Revolution, they did as much as they could to sanitize the biography of Tchaikovsky. And by that time, he'd been dead for 20 years, and so the Soviet biographers were going through all the official records and taking out anything they could find that would cast any kind of aspersion on his craft. And so that made it a challenge for modern biographers to actually figure out what it was that Tchaikovsky really thought. The fortunate thing is that he did write a lot of letters, and he did keep extensive personal notes. He had an autobiography which he gave to his brother shortly before he died. And that contains a lot of useful information. It contains a lot of his own personal thoughts, which actually provide a window into the things that he was thinking about. He actually did get married at one point, and that was probably to please his family, because he was a bachelor for his entire life, except for 2 months in 1869 or 1870. And he did this because he felt that, you know, this would take the scrutiny of the state, which was run by the Tsar at the time, that it would remove the scrutiny from his life. But of course the marriage was a disaster, and he realized after the fact that it was a grave mistake, because then of course the question was, well, why did it fail? And he had this to say, this came from his autobiography. He says, "There is no doubt that for some months on end, I was a bit insane, and only now, when I'm completely recovered," this is after the marriage ended, "have I learned to relate objectively to everything I did during my brief insanity. The man who in May took it into his head to marry Antonina Ivanova, and who during June wrote a whole opera as though nothing had happened, and who in July got married, and who in September fled from his marriage, and who in November fled to Rome, and so on. That man was not I, that man was another Pyotr Ilyich Tchaikovsky." And so you can see that, you know, there's a certain amount of, you know, assumed schizophrenia, if you will, as he's trying to grapple with all the things that are happening. Well, so that background, of course, informs his art. And as he is finding his voice as a composer, the other challenge that he faces is the whole idea of what Russian music should really be. And it's at this point in history, in the 1870s and 1880s, that you have all of the nationalist movements in Europe and also in Russia that are starting to assert themselves. And I've told you in previous pre-concert talks that people like Dvorak, of course, took all of his native Slavic melodies and wove those into his operas and his symphonies. And I've mentioned that when we played Mavlast by Vedrik Smetana a few years back, Smetana was himself Czech Bohemian, and so Mavlast was translated as "my fatherland." So he's writing music about his native Bohemia. And of course, Brahms gets on the bandwagon. He writes the Hungarian dances. Brahms is German, he's not Hungarian, but he realizes that people like this music. So Tchaikovsky is dealing with the same thing. And he has this tremendous body of work that comes from ancient Russian history. The Russians, of course, trace themselves back through the Cossacks of the 15th century and Alexander Nevsky from the 13th century, and of course there's a long history before that, and there's a lot of music associated with that. So Tchaikovsky is drawing on these roots, and he's following the major composers of the day, Mussorgsky and Rimsky-Korsakov and Borodin. And these guys are the ones who are enforcing what they think Russian music should be. It should be patriotic, it should talk about Russian history, it should have bold melodies. And it should be evocative of what the Russian Empire is, because the Russian Empire is greater than any other empire. And of course, these are the kinds of things that lead to a schism in music, and eventually, of course, a schism in politics as well. And World War I, naturally, is the result of that. So Tchaikovsky is struggling against the actions of the mighty handful. This is the name that the five composers give themselves. They're the ones who run the St. Petersburg Conservatory, and they're the ones who basically dictate what Russian music should be. And Tchaikovsky is spending a lot of time listening to the European masters. He's actually studying music theory. He's learning what Beethoven did, and he actually becomes quite a critic as well. And he publishes quite a bit of his music criticism. He thought Beethoven was fabulous. He considered Brahms, who is a contemporary, to be overrated. And he also took Schumann to task for his poor orchestration. And he actually wrote all these things in journals, which you can look up and translate in English if you want. So he's dealing with all of these things, and he's also dealing with the criticism that he's getting from the mighty handful. And Mussorgsky is one of the ones who criticizes an early ballet that Tchaikovsky writes. And this hits him terribly because, you know, he knows that he's got the talent, he knows that this is a good piece of music, but he has to please the authorities. Now, you might remember that this is somewhat more difficult a task than you might think. You might remember when I told you the story last season about Dmitri Shostakovich. And that composer literally had to write music to save his life. Because in that case, the totalitarian state had decided what music was and was not. And if you didn't follow those rules, you would pay for it with your life. So Tchaikovsky isn't facing that grave a danger, but he is up against the nature of how is music to be written? What is it that makes music music? And if I write music that is, quote, European, why does that matter if other people are writing Russian music and yet it sounds the same? Well, so that's an interesting question. And that raises the question of, well, what does it actually mean to write Russian music? How is Russian music different from European music? Well, at the time, a lot of Russian music was very heavy on virtuosic performance. You would have soloists who could play things that were technically so difficult that other soloists could not. And so you had Rimsky-Korsakov writing very difficult solo pieces in his ballets that he would write for particular instrumentalists that he knew about. And so European musicians and composers would complain about this because they would say, well, you're writing music that's interesting and exacting, but it lacks soul. And then you have the conflict then between European musicians and composers complaining that Tchaikovsky's music isn't European enough, and Russian composers complaining that it isn't Russian enough. And so the result of all of this then is that Tchaikovsky actually spends a lot of time experimenting with different things. So in the symphony that you're going to hear tonight, you'll hear that he takes one single theme. He has many themes in the symphony, but he takes one theme and he pervades it throughout all four movements. La, 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 la. And he takes that and he takes, it's a major theme, but he makes it minor in various movements and he inverts it in other places. And he adds additional orchestration and additional contrapuntal mechanisms. That's where you have music that is happening at the same time, different themes happening at the same time, where he gets those things to play against each other. And it works out to great success. And so Tchaikovsky winds up being very successful with a lot of stuff that he writes. He's still fighting all of this personal turmoil. When he writes the 1812 overture, he actually said at one point that he felt he had no soul when he wrote that music. He said it's very bombastic and it's very loud and people will probably appreciate it for that, but I didn't give anything of myself when I wrote it. So the Fifth Symphony is actually different in that sense because he knew that he was pouring out himself into the music. And so all of these things are happening at the same time. He's dealing with the academy, thank you, that is still looking over all of the music that he's writing. And even Mussorgsky is a person who is saying that the conservatory is a place where professors dressed in, quote, professional anti-musical togas first pollute their students' minds and then seal them with various abominations. And the imagery is biblical because people are very passionate about what they think music should be. So as Tchaikovsky's career continues, he begins to see a great deal of success because he is writing music that transcends culture. It transcends history. It's not associated with nationalist Russian movements. It draws upon a lot of different musical backgrounds, and therefore it appeals to a wide variety of audiences. So towards the end of his career, Tchaikovsky starts receiving lots of accolades. He receives from Tsar Alexander, he receives the Order of Saint Vladimir, which comes with a hereditary peerage. So he becomes the equivalent in Russian society, becomes the equivalent of a Sir Peter Tchaikovsky. And he starts to travel around the world. And he actually performed the inaugural concert at Carnegie Hall in 1891. Such was his fame at the time. He was friends with Dvorak, and he also invited both Dvorak and Brahms to come to Moscow and perform. And so, in any case, the symphony that you're going to hear tonight, wonderful piece of music, there's a lot that is actually going on, and I will close with this quote that he had to say about it. From his autobiography, from his notebook in April of 1888, he would live for only 5 more years. He said this, "I describe this piece as a complete resignation before fate, which is the same as an inscrutable predestination of fate." He's pouring himself into the music, he's letting it be what it will be, and then the music shall live on. Tchaikovsky possibly committed suicide. We don't know this. We do know that he died of cholera, but there is a fairly large school of thought that suggests that he actually poisoned himself, and that this would be a way for him to die with a certain amount of dignity after living this very complicated life. So I will leave you with this symphony, and again, it's a rich piece of music. It's a personal favorite of mine. I probably say that about all these symphonies. It's probably true. So take my bias and enjoy it. So enjoy the concert.
Tonight, in another half an hour, the Stanford Orchestra will be playing Tchaikovsky's Fourth Symphony while we're playing Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony. Tchaikovsky was a great melodist, witnessed the popularization of some melodies in the 30s and 40s. Dee-da-da-dee-da-da-da-dee-da-da. That's a great melody. There are lots of melodies here to listen to and to remember that you can take away and sing on the way home.
It will happen.
That doesn't always happen in music. One of the things that will tie all this together, and it has relevance to what you're saying about melodies being from one movement to the next, to the next, to the next, the very opening, da, da da da, da 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 da. It starts right out, no introduction. Actually, that whole section is an introduction. But it starts out in minor with the clarinets. Deem da da deem da da deem da. That sounds sort of Russian, doesn't it?
I think so.
But later on, you're going to hear the trumpets going. Dum, 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 bum, 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 which is a transformation of the theme, and in the last movement starts out yum, ba-da-dum, ba-da-dum, bum. Same rhythm, Same length of notes. It starts off in the first movement, sotto voce in minor. Last movement starts out in major, a very bright feel. So you're going to hear this theme, and it's being transformed from one movement to the next. That's it. Okay? Enjoy.